The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today we're going to go back into our Book Nook archive and pull out the only interview I have ever done with a writer from Indiana. Her name is Haven Kimmel, and she had just published a novel when we did this interview in studio, live, in Yellow Springs in 2003 for her novel, The Solace of Leaving Early. And Haven had had a really nice break in her career because she was recommended by Elizabeth Berg, the best-selling novelist, who got famous after she had an Oprah pick for one of her novels. And Elizabeth was on the Today Show, and she said, you really need to read Haven Kimmel's memoir. And it became a bestseller. And after she published that book, she put out this novel, and we talked about it back in 2003. We call it The Best of the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Haven Kimmel. Her new book is called The Solace of Leaving Early. Welcome back to Yellow Springs. I hear you've been here before.
I have, yes, thank you. It's a lovely town.
I won't ask what you were doing here, but I know you're from Indiana. Didn't you go to Ball State?
I did. I did my undergraduate at Ball State, and then I went to seminary in Earlham, at Earlham in Richmond, Indiana.
Well, that's just down the road. In fact, our signal breaks up, I think, right about Earlham.
I think most signals break up right about Earlham, yeah.
Ball State, isn't that Dan Quayle's alma mater?
No, David Letterman.
Oh, okay. I knew.
That's shameless that you would say that.
Where did he go? Did he even go to college?
I think that he went to kindergarten, and then after that, who knows?
Well, it's a terrible thing to waste interview time talking about Dan Quayle. Haven, you wrote a book called A Girl Named Zippy, and I've heard a lot of buzz about this book. What was the story with that? Was that your memoir?
That was a memoir. Mm-hmm. That was the story of growing up in a town of 300, a farm town of 300 in East Central Indiana in the 60s and 70s. And in some ways, it's about the discrepancy between what the 60s and 70s were like in the rest of the world as opposed to what they were like in Indiana and Ohio. And then also just what it's like to grow up in a town of 300, which is, I thought, an unusual experience. As it turns out, after the book came out and in interviews and in talking to readers and fans, what I discovered is that most people grew up in a town of 300 in one way or another. You know, I would meet a reader from Brooklyn who would say, really, Brooklyn for me was 300 people because it was my block and my grocery store and my bus driver and my elementary school, and that's all I knew. You know, I didn't know the whole city. So in that way, it turned out to be more a universal story than I thought. It's a comedy. It's comedic essays.
What was the name of the town?
Moreland, Indiana.
Moreland.
Mm-hmm.
And then this book, I'm guessing, is your first published work of fiction?
That's right.
The Solace of Leaving Early, and it just came out in paperback. Your main character in this book is a woman named Langston. Now, that's a kind of name for a woman kind of like Haven, isn't it? It's an unusual name.
It is, yes, yeah. It is. And in fact, her name, writers feel differently about this, about naming characters. And there's and sort of you travel the you know, you travel the continuum between names that suggest almost nothing, you know, a kind of neutrality, to names that suggest an allegorical significance. And I tend to fall closer to allegory, I think, though really all I want is for the characters to have the name they're supposed to have. You know, this is the only name that this character could have. So it takes a long time of sort of sitting and listening to what's being suggested about the person and the right name for them. So Amos, the other protagonist, is named Amos Townsend, and the same is true of him. You know, it's a his name is suggestive, but not entirely allegorical.
Suggestive of the prophet.
Suggestive of the prophet. In the book, you know, the book of Amos is particularly concerned with justice, and then Townsend, since he is in some ways the spirit of the town they dwell in, the two of them.
Amos is a very unusual character. Everybody around him seems to die.
I hadn't really noticed that. That's true.
Yeah. Especially that weird church he was assigned to, where they said, we have an older congregation and we want you to stay there until every congregate has passed away.
Right.
That was really bizarre.
You know, it's odd. Because I thought that I made that up. Well, I did make that up. And then very, very shortly after the book came out, my mother was actually offered a small Quaker meeting. And there are about nine people who go to it, and they're all very, very old. And so my mother is looking at the same eventuality. And then last night I read in Cincinnati, and a woman came up to me who had ministered to a church exactly the same way. So it does actually happen. And must just be, I mean, I would guess that it would be a very difficult task. It would be, if what you were looking for in the world was God's work, whatever that means to you, that would be it, I think.
My guess is Haven Kimmel, the book is The Solace of Leaving Early. Yellow Springs has a very strong Quaker community, and I'm guessing that you come from a similar situation.
Yes, I was raised Quaker. Mm-hmm.
And seminary school was Earlham's Quaker, right?
Right, that's okay. Right.
How does a person come out of that environment and become a best-selling author?
Well, that's a good question. It's, well, out of the whole environment, really, because I mentioned to someone yesterday that saying that I wanted to be a writer in the town of Moreland, Indiana, was as odd as saying I wanted to be a shepherd. You know, there just aren't any, and no one does that. When I was growing up, I didn't know really anyone who even read books except for my mother and my best friend's mother, and other than that, there just weren't books in evidence at all. So, thank goodness that my mother had read. I don't know. Oh, well, I'd be a shepherd, obviously.
This book is very mysterious because we have Amos and we have Langston, and we're trying to figure out what their deal is. We're trying to understand why they act the way that they do, and you feel a certain negative magnetism between the two of them. They really despise one another.
Right.
And it's very powerful. The, mm-hmm. the tension that you create there really moves the book along.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, I think in some ways it's just the formula of the romantic comedy. You always introduce your protagonists and have them hate one another, and they always hate one another because they're so similar. And Langston and Amos don't appear to be similar on the surface, but in fact, Amos realizes first that there are, you know, these strange esoteric religious texts or philosophical questions that he can discuss with almost no one, but he could certainly discuss them with Langston in this town of 3,000, you know, in the middle of Indiana. And so the fact that they despise one another and yet are sort of in mutual exile, I think, is what brings them together and also makes them so angry. Yeah.
I was really amazed by all the religious undertones in this book and the way that there's so much tragedy, but it's an uplifting form of tragedy because it makes people stronger. How did you get the idea for the story?
Well, when I left Earlham, I specifically studied Alfred North Whitehead, a change philosopher who's important to this novel, when I was at Earlham. And what I wanted to do was to go on and do a PhD and write a dissertation on Whitehead and the nature of grief. And And I decided not to do that. I was actually accepted to a PhD program at Claremont, California. There's a Center for Process Studies. And I decided not to go there and instead wrote Zippy in the year that I would have been in graduate school. And one day I was talking to a friend on the phone and I said, you know, I'm glad that I made this decision, but I'll always regret not writing that book on grief and the possibilities in grief, this sort of the possibility for radical change or radical beauty. And she said, you know, you actually are a writer. You don't have to go to graduate school to write that. You could write that as a novel. And from that moment on, I realized, oh, that's exactly right. I could dramatize those ideas that I had rather than making it just academic.
Let's talk a little bit more about your characters. I really loved Langston and the way she communicated with those two little girls. And their whole process together of conversation, here she's speaking like this ultra academic, right. And they're totally with her in mm-hmm. the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually grew out of my own, we should say who the little girls are. There's a tragedy at the heart of the book in which, and two little girls are left orphaned, and Langston and Amos are made mutually responsible for these children. And Langston, so Langston as a character grew, I'm glad to hear you say that you loved her because I think there's a kind of a division between people who are profoundly irritated by her and people who are moved by her. I'm very, very fond of her myself. She grew out of this idea, a conversation I had with my mom, in which, so I believe that another way that the world is divided is, do you love A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole or not? If you are right, you love it. And if you are wrong, you do not. My mother does not love it. And yet I respect her. And I want us to be able to have sort of normal adult conversations. So I have to convince her to love this novel. So we were driving in the car one day. And she said, but Haven, Ignatius J. Reilly is just, he's just disgusting. And I said, Mom, yes, he's disgusting, but that's not the point. The point is this, and then I rambled off this whole thesis about him. And I said, well, think about it this way. What if he were a girl? Well, you know, what if all the disgusting parts of his nature were left out, but that sort of terrible insecurity and his intellectualism that masks this brokenness was still present? And she said, well, then he'd be just like you.
Oh.
So I decided, I'll take, because of course when you write characters, you employ slivers of yourself again and again. No fictional character is wholly the author, but there's always some little element of yourself. And so I put that in Langston, that idea I had about Ignatius J. Reilly. And that's how she came to be the sort of problematic person that she is. But her communication with those children is based actually on my raising of my own daughter, who is now 19. But when she was a little girl, it seemed to me the best thing to do would be just to talk to her like she was a person, just to talk to her like she was one of us rather than a little alien or a subhuman or something. And so we began having very normal, reasonable conversations from the time that she was quite small, and that worked just fine. So I gave that to Langston, and it worked fine for her as well.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community. And back in 2003, Haven Kimmel drove out to Yellow Springs from her home in Indiana to record this interview that you're hearing right now, my only interview with Haven Kimmel, recorded 18 years ago, and we'll continue with that right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 2003, I did my only interview with Haven Kimmel. She had had a best-selling memoir, and she had just published her first novel called The Solace of Leaving Early. Wasn't the author of Confederacy of Dunces the fellow who took his own life and then his mother got the book published? Was it his mother?
That's right.
Okay.
The book was rejected 100 times and by 100 publishers. And he in despair over, I'm sure, a number of factors, but that was one of them, committed suicide. And his mother, in her own grief, began carrying the manuscript and all that existed of the manuscript. There was one copy that had that actually was a carbon, and so it was smudged and blue. And she took it to Walker Percy at Louisiana State University Press. And he says in the introduction to that book that he feared beginning it because he feared having to say to this terrible, you know, to this woman suffering this terrible grief, I can't publish this book. And then after he began it, he feared going on because of how brilliant it actually was, and how sad it was for the world that the author was gone.
Why do you love it so much?
I love it because it's one of the funniest books ever written, I think, and brutally so. You know, it's very dark, and I love it because he didn't invent this. This is a narrative device that you can see really even in not just in Western writing but also in Russian literature, but in sort of contemporary literature. Ignatius is the embodiment of a particular idea, which is that a person can be unreliable. I can be speaking to you, and what I'm saying is not reliable factually, and I don't seem to realize it, but I'm revealing the truth to you even as I hide it from myself. And Ignatius reveals the truth to the reader about himself and about his condition while hiding it from himself at the same time. And even in that, he makes it funny, which is just an act of genius, I think.
My guess is Haven Kimmel. The book is The Solace of Leaving Early. Langston, I'm sure she has some slivers of you, but I'm guessing her mother has some slivers of your mother. I really loved her mother.
I love her mother too, Anna Lee. Yes, yeah. She there's a particular scene where she's walking down the alley, the dark alley, to visit Amos, who's sitting on his back porch one night, and he sees her approaching like a ship on a calm sea. And she is that. That's what I intended her to be. In some ways, she's the antithesis of Langston. She's sweet reason in the world, but very firm.
And then there's the shadow of the brother that's cast over this whole story.
Right.
And he's named after a town in New Mexico.
Right. Taos. His name is Taos. The place her parents honeymooned. Yes. Yeah, Taos is missing at the beginning of the book, and he's missing at the end. He's just a missing person.
So what's the process for you? How does a book like this assemble itself? How does it take its form?
This book took form differently, I hope, than any other I write, because it was my first novel, and I wanted to do it as well as I possibly could, and I also was on a deadline. And which is a toxic combination, and I wrote 500 pages, and they went astray, and they went astray way back, like at page 150. It was a horrible thing to watch, you know, like an accident on a freeway, and one night I had a dream about these two little girls, and it was very, very brief. I just saw them run up a hill, and they were dressed the way they are in the novel. And I woke up and knew who they were, and I knew where I had gone wrong in the book. The original book was an academic comedy. It was just Langston in an academic comedy. And I threw all 500 pages away and started over. And it was, you know, it was rather like removing one's own kidney to throw 500 pages away. I don't ever want to do that again. But I have since written a new novel that comes out in January, which is the second in a trilogy that takes place in this fictional county. And
same people?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, different people. It's Hopwood County, Indiana, and this one takes place in Roseville. The protagonist is a young woman who becomes a pool hustler to support her family.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like fun. So you got a 3-book deal on this. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised with the success of A Girl Named Zippy, and how did you get a book deal?
I was a graduate teaching fellow in the English department at North Carolina State University. And in the way these things sometimes happen, the manuscript of Zippy was placed in the hands of Lee Smith, sort of unbeknownst to me, who's a Southern novelist, an Appalachian novelist, brilliant, brilliant woman. And she read it over a weekend and then came into my office and said, I think you should send this to this list of agents. And she had even drawn up the 5 agents she thought I should send it to. And I sent it to the first one, and she picked it up in April, and she sold it in June.
Was she just the first one on the list, or did mm-hmm. you pick her?
Sort of both. Uh-huh. She was the person that Lee recommended because of her position in the industry.
Uh-huh.
And so within 2 months, that book and this one had sold, even though this one did not exist.
And I'm guessing in the parlance of the book industry that the first book started out as a hand sell with people in bookstores saying, you got to read this, because that seems to really power books by previously unknown writers.
That's right. Yes, I owe all of my success to independent bookstores, and I'm immensely grateful to them. And Zippy was a bookseller's favorite. That's really where its world was among independent booksellers, and not the chains at all. The chains ignored it.
I love that diner. I have had these waitresses wait on me. I've met these women.
Yes.
I love how you can take, what's her name, Lou? She's just barely in the book. I think she's only in 2 paragraphs.
Right.
And we know this woman.
Yeah.
And then this other waitress, the one that's got the buttons.
Selma Sue, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she, I had aid in drawing that diner, because my sister actually owns a diner in LaSanteville, Indiana. And so, and when I'm home, you know, when I'm home visiting, which is frequently, you know, I might eat twice a day at my sister's diner. So I encounter those people again and again and again, and it's easy to draw a sketch of what it's like to eat in a diner in a small town in Ohio or Indiana once you've done it often enough.
And Amos, he's from this area, isn't he? Isn't he from around this area somewhere?
He is. The town he grew up in, I modeled after Middletown.
Oh.
And then moved him, I guess, in his educational life. He went to Ohio State and then moved him sort of toward Dayton and then eventually over the Indiana line, just barely over the Indiana line.
Which is all very logical if you're from this part of the world.
Right.
It all makes sense.
Right. You can see it. Yeah, you can see it. The very few people sort of zeroed in on where he was from in Ohio, except Ohioans who said, I knew exactly, I could pinpoint on a map where he was going at each, you know, at each change in his life.
Well, I didn't know it was Middletown, but when I saw him go to Dayton, I figured it was around here somewhere. And
right.
Middletown's in our listening area, so.
Right.
If you're down there in Middletown, Amos is from your town.
He is, and he says good things about it.
The book is The Solace of Leaving Early. Was it hard to pick a title?
No, I dreamed that title at the same time that I dreamed about those little girls. I mean, I know I sound like a total kook now.
Well, definitely. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's the only time I've ever done that, and it worked really well. Thank you to the unconscious for that one. And I also knew that as the sort of metaphorical theme of the book, which is what it is, when I began the book again with that title and the plot line involving those children, I knew what the metaphorical theme was, and I knew how it needed to be pulled, you know, through the book from beginning to end. So it was really given to me.
And is that a secret, what the metaphorical theme was? Is that something you like to talk about?
No, it's not a secret. In fact, sometimes at readings I choose very specifically to read the passage that explicates the title, which takes place basically in the middle of the book in chapter 12 called At Intermission. And in that scene, Langston remembers her missing brother, Taos, she remembers going to the opera with him when she was 18 years old. It was a Christmas present from him. He took her to see La Boheme at Clues Hall in Indianapolis. And when the play began, and she was blissfully happy to be sitting there. And at intermission, her brother turned to her and said, "Are you enjoying yourself?" And she said, "Yes, I'm having a wonderful time." And he said, "Let's leave then, shall we?" And she agreed. And she knew why he said that, because it's often better to leave in the middle than to wait for the heroine to die in the cold. And so Langston, in this case, really wants to continue leaving in the middle. It's important to her to have the freedom to run. And she ends up back in Haddington, which is not her heart's desire, and is forced to stay. So in many ways, the book is about what happens to us when we're forced to stay. Amos is facing the same situation, and so are all the other people in the town. This is where we are. This is where we have to be. Whereas Taos is long, long gone, fled before the tragedy. So that's really it. It's just about the pressures life, you know, puts upon you, the way that it bears down on us.
Can we juxtapose the solace of leaving the opera early with a half-read sentence?
Yes, there are a lot of, I think there's a long history of that, especially in this country. We believe very much in mobility. We believe very, and mobility started out, I think, in this, in our American psyche as physical, and it became psychological. So now we're unprepared to stay anywhere. We're unprepared to stay in any situation that makes us uncomfortable. We're unprepared to finish the sentence or finish the book or whatever. And that's the dilemma that Langston faces in the most physical manifestation, in the clearest way possible. You are in a place you don't want to be, and you're raising children who are not your own, and you have to stay. What do you do? That's basically it.
And then we can juxtapose Langston, who is dearly loved by her parents. And I think that's a real reason why she is okay, because
that's right.
Her parents care so much about her.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that parental love, which she takes for granted at the beginning of the book, not only takes for granted, but dismisses, really, in the way that really loved people do, take it for granted. It nonetheless comes to play immediately in her relationship with those children. She knows exactly how to love them, as it turns out. Who would have guessed it? You know, this impossible, arch, brittle academic, you know, who is, last night at a reading, I described her as the Fraser Crane of the Midwest. You know, she's always on the lookout for someone trying to lower her standards. But she faces those children and immediately knows exactly how to love them the way they need to be loved.
And speaking of Fraser Crane, Amos is a little bit like his character in The Simpsons that he plays, the guy with the wild hair who's kind of a tall beanpole, Ichabod Crane type. What's his name? Sideshow Bob. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. Yes, that's exactly right. He does look sort of like Sideshow Bob. Good one. That's good. You know, someone came up to me at a reading and said that she could not, while reading the book, she couldn't stop picturing Jeff Goldblum. Which is also true. If Jeff Goldblum wasn't so, you know, buff and movie star like if he were completely anemic and, you know, spent his entire week in a study staring out a window, that's what Amos would look like, I think.
Well, we all know the guy that walks down the sidewalk and he tries to look like he's in control of his body, and his hair's getting caught in the tree, and he's
right.
Stumbling into things. We know him. They're kind of nerdy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a great big nerd.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting my 2003 interview with Haven Kimmel, and we'll bring you the final segment of that conversation right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, my conversation recorded back in 2003 with Haven Kimmel talking about her novel. And don't touch that dial, because we've got a Book Nook bonus coming your way as well following this segment with Haven Kimmel right here on the Best of the Book Nook.
What's this been like for you to have so much success with your book, A Girl Named Zippy? Has this been a life-changing thing? Have you had to become a hermit, or were you a hermit already?
Well, most writers are fairly hermit-like, but I'm contractually obligated to do a great deal of promotion, and so I have to. I sort of have to have two speeds rather than one. The one speed I used to have, which was writing, I have to, you know, I have to go out into the world and meet the people over and over and over again. I'm asked that question with some frequency if it changed my life, and I would have to say that it changed some of the details of my life, but it did not touch my inner life at all, and it didn't affect my real life in any way. It does make it possible for me to put my daughter through college, which is really all that I was looking for. And if a big truck had backed up to the door and spilled money in my living room rather than having sold Zippy, it would feel the same way, like, oh, thank you, truck. You know, I appreciate that. I just wanted to get this little bird out of the nest and on her own safely, and Zippy has allowed me to do that, so I'm grateful for that.
So was Zippy your nickname?
Zippy was my nickname growing up, and in fact, my father still shamelessly calls me that. Look at me. I don't look anything like Zippy.
It's better than Stinky.
It's much better than Stinky. There are a number of more onerous nicknames, yes. I will answer the phone now at my age, and my dad will say, Zip. And I know exactly. There's my dad.
You know it's him.
Yeah. I'm still 6 years old on roller skates.
That's a great nickname.
Yeah.
I can see how it would bug you after a while. I used to have a nickname of Nipper, and I never really understood that. And they explained to me it was because I look like a guy. He looked exactly like me, they claimed, and he was a kleptomaniac, and they called him Little Nipper, so they started calling me Nipper. I was named after a kleptomaniac. It's like, oh, that's really good.
That's much worse. Well, I mean, I was nicknamed after a roller skating chimp. So, and when you see the cover of Zippy, you know, the baby on the cover of Zippy, which, and again and again and again, people will say to me, is that really your baby picture? And I always say, would I borrow that little monkey face from someone else? No, of course it's me. Yes. And I continued to have the sort of simian look for for years, tragically so.
These two little girls, Immaculata and Epiphany, not their real names, but their adopted names, mm-hmm. After things happen. Immaculata, she's really got a strong personality, doesn't she?
She does, yes, she does. And in fact, she, when I was had just begun this novel, I went to a Catholic school and spent some days there watching third graders and watching kindergartners and first graders to make sure. I have a son who just finished first grade, so I know a little bit about them, but not really the girls, you know, at this, what girls are like right now. And there was this girl in that third grade classroom, and every move she made was so precise and so filled with a nearly adult confidence, and I couldn't figure out if it were actually confidence or if it were overcompensation for some, you know, some deep-seated fear, or I just couldn't tell. And but I really liked her. I liked the sort of toughness of her and the way that she, all of her answers were correct. All of her, you know, the minute I said to the class, tell me what you're reading these days, her hand went straight up in the air. There was nothing she was afraid of. And so in some ways, I based Immaculata on her. And in other ways, she's drawn out of necessity the way that she would have to be for this book. So she's both a completely fictional and psychological creation, and then also modeled on this beautiful child I saw.
I am neglecting to mention the dog. The dog is all through this story, and the dog has a special role.
The dog has a very special role, germane, as in germane to this conversation, yes. A shepherd,
uh-huh.
A rescue dog. In fact, dogs appear in all of my books because I am, I'm obsessed with them. I'm obsessed with dogs. I have 5 dogs myself, and I work with dog rescue and fostering, and so I don't understand a life that doesn't have dogs in it. So of course they appear in my books, because I can't imagine a human life without a dog in it. And Germaine is a nearly mythical figure. And at one point, Amos sees Langston and Germaine walking down the street, and he says it looked exactly like the mythological representation of a woman and a beast. And that's what he is. He is the absolute touchstone for Langston's sanity. Any time that she feels less than stable, Germaine reminds her, you know, this is planet Earth. You know, here is where you are, and you're safe. So yes, he's critical to the story.
I'm going to guess that another splinter of Langston that is something directly from you is the fact that she's so well-read, and she's read so many very ponderous tomes. I'm guessing that you've dove into that ocean of books.
Yes, I was in addition to being in seminary for 2.5 years, I then went to graduate school in English, and one has to do something with all that education. It's hard to, but I don't know what. I mean, you know, I didn't know what to do with it, so I sort of just gave the whole of that bounty to Langston and let her do what she wanted with it. So yes, I gave my academic history to her and my literary history to her.
What's the deal with John Donne?
John Donne. I developed a terrible crush on John Donne when I was in graduate school. I also have a terrible crush on Elvis Presley. So you know how the way that some people draw up a celebrity sex list, and mine is all a dead celebrity sex list. I'm not interested in any live people, but John Donne really. And I studied him in graduate school, and when in the first draft of this book, when it was an academic comedy, Langston was a Donne scholar. That's originally what she did. And so when the book evolved into what it is now, Donne is, in the same way that Kierkegaard is sort of a ghost that just hovers over the narrative. So, you know, neither of them are actually writing dissertations on Donne or Kierkegaard, but they're present all the time in the way that Whitehead is present all the time.
So Langston's a little more like you than you might admit. Huh?
Amos is too.
Amos too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Amos is too. Amos is my taller half, I guess.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, it's really a wonderful book, and I truly enjoyed reading it, and I see that the San Francisco Chronicle agreed. They said it's packed with astute allusions. I always love a quote like that.
Yeah.
I have no idea what they mean, but I love the quote.
Yeah, I know. They put it right there on the cover. Isn't that funny? Yeah. Astute allusions, so you say. Yeah, it did. It got the book was universally well reviewed, which amazes me. It just amazes me every time, because I thought that I thought it would, you know, that there would be at least a few reviewers who would pillory the notion of Langston, and there was only one exception to the general tone of all those reviews that are in the beginning of the book. And that was actually in my local progressive independent in Durham, North Carolina, where I live, the paper I trust more than any other. And the reviewer said many, many, many nice things about the book, and then said, however, Kimmel, you know, stretches credibility by asking us to believe that in a town in Indiana, in a town of 3,000 in Indiana, conversations about Kierkegaard and John Donne and, you know, esoteric branches of Eastern religions would actually be discussed. And it was the only time ever that I have almost responded to a reviewer. I almost wrote to him and said, you know, I'm sorry to plead the obvious, but in fact, that's where I'm from, and I wrote the book. You know, so it must be possible. It has to be possible. But those prejudices are very difficult to not only to address, but certainly to erase. In the mind of the rest of the world, if you live in the Bible Belt or the Corn Belt or whatever, there's no chance that you're having an intelligent conversation. It's just not happening.
Well, that reviewer needs to come to the heart of the Bible Belt and the Corn Belt, Yellow Springs.
Yellow Springs. Yes, he would be very shocked.
We talk about Kierkegaard down at the coffee shop almost every day.
Well, you probably even talk about Kant down at the coffee shop.
We talk about all kinds of things down at the coffee shop.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was my 2003 interview with Haven Kimmel for her novel, The Solace of Leaving Early. And we have a little extra time on the program, and we're going to bring you a little treat. Back in 2002, I interviewed a very literary songwriter named John Darnielle. And we talked about the music of his band, The Mountain Goats. Enjoy.
And that was music from The Mountain Goats. And that was John Darnielle, who joins us through the miracle of telephonic sound. John.
Hey.
What's up?
Nothing much. How are you?
I'm good. The Mountain Goats, Tallahassee, the new album. This is a very interesting album. Why Tallahassee?
Well, the songs are all about the same couple of people who I've had in my head for a long time, and the arc of the story has always been they start out in Southern California, where I'm from, and they're trying to run away from the problems they make for each other, and so they just flee eastward, and they sort of run out of emotional gas once they get to Northern Florida, and they stop running, and they buy a rundown house and sort of decompose into one another's issues out there.
You say you came from a poetic background. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, I always wanted to be a writer from the time I was very young, but my short stories were not very good. And and when I was 14, I started writing poetry, and I had this amazing professor named Rosemary Adam, who was a real encouragement, and I started winning contests sort of right and left when I was 14 and 15. And so that was what I focused on writing-wise for the longest time, and was starting to get published when I was 24-ish, was starting to get published in the Spoon River Quarterly, which is out of Ohio. Some of the earlier poems involved this couple that this whole album is about, and I started setting some of them to music just to see how it would pan out, and then fairly quickly transitioned into just writing songs all the time and out of poetry. It seemed like an easier way of getting words across.
That song that we just heard, Game Shows Touch, I get the impression you've watched a little television.
Yeah, I watch a lot of television, rather too much. We actually just, my wife and I just put in the order for the season hockey package last night, so we'll now have more hockey than we can possibly shake a goalie stick at.
What's your team?
I like the New York Islanders a lot, but I'm really into the Tampa Bay Lightning this year. They're like 7-1-1, and they're really good. And I'm always for the teams that always lose. Those are my favorite teams. So I like the Islanders. I like the Lightning. The Calgary Flames. Those are all teams that I'm for.
And it gets pretty lonely out in Story County, Iowa, in the winter. So hockey probably sounds like a good way to pass the time.
Well, my wife plays hockey actually on the Iowa State women's team. So
really?
Yeah. It's pretty great. So I watched that. Skating's great all together. It's something you don't really do a lot of in Southern California, where I grew up.
And where is she from in Minnesota?
This is the best part about her playing hockey. She grew up in Northern Iowa, but she's from Thailand. To the best of my knowledge, she's the first Thai-American women's hockey player in the history of Story County. I'd be surprised if anybody could counter that claim.
I know you lived in Colo.
Yeah.
Is she from Mason City?
No, she's from Spirit Lake.
Spirit Lake, okay. So northwest Iowa.
Yeah.
My guest is John Darnielle, and the new album by the Mountain Goats is Tallahassee. How many albums is it now?
Oh, God, I have no idea. When I first started making records, I was in this, I go through bursts, you know, and I was in a huge burst. I think it's something like 7 or 8 full lengths outside of the 3 singles concept. I can probably count them up real fast. There was the first Ajax album, There's two eight-song EPs or eight- and nine-song EPs. Then there's Nothing for Juice. That's two albums. Sweden, Full Force Galesburg, Corners Gambit, All Hail West Texas. I think this would be number eight if you don't count the cassettes.
Okay. And this is on 4AD, which I remember. Whenever I think of this label, I think of the Cocteau Twins.
Yeah, me too.
How did you hook up with them?
They were friends with a mutual friend named Jamie Tugwell over in London, who works at the Rough Trade Shop. I guess they were talking one night and talking about what's good, and the subject of me came up, and Jamie called and said, you know, my friends at 4AD seem kind of interested. Are you interested? And I said, well, yeah. I mean, they put out so many records that I bought. You know, the Cocteau Twins' Victoria Land took me through a whole season in Portland. And
This Mortal Coil?
Yeah, pretty mm-hmm. great. The Pixies, of course, and the Throwing mm-hmm. Muses, and all kinds of stuff. So, and they put out The Birthday Party in England, and The Birthday Party was just a huge, huge thing for me. Mm-hmm. So so we got in touch, and there you are.
My guest is John Darnielle. Are the Mountain Goats you and whoever you're playing with?
Pretty much. I mean, right now it's me and Peter Hughes, and we just completed a two-week U.S. tour of the East, hooking down through the Southeast. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I released whole albums at All Hail West Texas, the one that came out in February. That was just me.
Oh. Can a guy make a living as a mountain goat?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't know. I did for a year or so, but that didn't, you know, I didn't do my best writing when I wasn't doing actual work. I work as a counselor for young people, young women right now, ages 9 through 13, in a residential setting. I kind of, you know, I'm torn between the strong belief that artists ought to do actual work mm-hmm. and the fact that I'm right now really swamped, and it's really, really hard to find time to do everything I need to do in my so-called off hours, you know. But my feeling has always been that you do your best art when it's something that you do for pleasure instead of as your full-time job.
Too much pressure.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's something precious about artists thinking that they should be paid just to, you know, be clever. So.
I've met a few.
Yeah. There's, I mean, you know, so many, as musicians especially, are, you know, just looking for the way to get over, to get out of the day job. And, of course, you know, who loves to punch the clock? Well, just people from Iowa, right? But yeah, so I work as much as I can. There's been talk this week of having to cut back hours even further just to accommodate touring schedule. But I'm really torn about that. I think it's good to work.
Is that up at Mary Greeley?
I used to work at Mary Greeley, actually. Mm-hmm. I work for Beloit now.
Oh, okay. My guest is John Darnielle, and the Mountain Goats is his band. They've got a new album out called Tallahassee. 4AD has a website. It's 4AD.com. Are you into websites? Do you have one?
There's my zine site that I do. I do a lot of music journalism, and I have a site called Last Plane to Jakarta, which is lastplanetojakarta.com, where I update once a week with records I've been listening to, you know, long-form essays, 2,000 to 3,000 words. I write about mostly heavy metal.
Wow. Well, we really appreciate you taking a moment to visit with us here.
Oh, sure.
And we've queued up a song. Tell us about this song. It's No Children.
Yeah. Well, I got the first line for it when I was flying down to Athens to play a music festival there about a year ago, and I was listening to this new country song. I don't know who it's by, but it's this Hallmarky song where it's a long series of platitudes where somebody says to their child, "Oh, I hope you still feel strong when you stand beside the ocean. Whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And the chorus is, "I hope you danced," right? Which I missang as, "I hope you die," as I was driving to the airport. And I held that in my head. I thought, well, that would be kind of funny, you know, if you had this sort of anti all these Hallmarky motivational speaker things. Held the idea in my head until I got down to Athens. And once I got in my hotel room, I wrote a rough sketch of the lyrics and hung on to them on hotel stationery until I got home. And then worked out the song.
Well, thanks so much for that intro. My guest has been John Darnielle, and this is The Mountain Goats.
Okay.
And that was John Darnielle of The Mountain Goats, a prolific songwriter. He's also a novelist, talking about his album Tallahassee back in 2002. Your Book Nook bonus this morning on The Best of the Book Nook, and tomorrow a very special Book Nook coming your way a half hour early at 10 a.m. Sunday morning. I'll be interviewing Lisa Scottolini. She has just published a new novel called Eternal, And it's a big departure for her. Why So Weekend will be on hiatus tomorrow morning, so tune in for a special hour-long Book Nook from 10 until 11 on Sunday morning right here on WYSO. Thanks for listening.